Hi, and good morning, everybody. Yeah. Thank you. And thank you for that wonderful introduction. I just want to point out for the record that despite the fact that I'm a Longhorn, my uncle went to A&M and we love him anyway. It's really a pleasure to be here in Provo. It's an honor. When I went to high school, one of my favorite teachers and mentors, Paul Whedon, was from BYU, and he often spoke of this campus and his education here. And so it means a lot to me to come here, get a chance to see what he experienced on the campus, what this beautiful town is all about, and have a chance to talk to all of you this morning. We're on slide one. We're in good shape. I'm going to tell you the story of New Horizons and emphasize a couple of things that I think are particularly important, some of the attributes of getting this amazing project done, attributes of commitment and collaboration, spread over a period of 26 years, from 1989, when we first had the idea for this, all the way out to 2015, when we accomplished the first exploration of Pluto, the farthest planet ever explored. But I want to start the story a little further back with my own beginnings. And just for a moment, you know, when I was a kid, all I ever wanted to do and all I can ever remember was wanting to grow up and be a scientist, and particularly to be involved in space exploration. This is a little bit dangerous, but I'm going to show this picture with my first scientific instrument, which is not a telescope but a microscope. And I think this was, I was 5 years old in this picture. Fortunately, they worked out. I took every science and math course that I could take in high school, and then I majored in physics and astronomy as an undergraduate, and then went to graduate school twice for master's degrees, and then eventually for a PhD in astrophysics, and have had the opportunity to have the career that I always dreamed of. And no one in my family had ever been involved in science or engineering in any STEM field. I had a lot of doubts whether I would be able to have a successful career at it, but it did work out. I've got to do just amazing things, a lot of opportunities to use telescopes all around the world, to participate in space missions, to be involved in actually crafting NASA's Science Enterprise, and I've had some other experiences as well. I did a South Polar expedition all the way down to the South Pole, and I spent 4 years flying research missions in NASA F-18s out of Dryden, which is at Edwards Air Force Base in California. But really the backbone of my career and what's been most rewarding, I think, the entire way has been being involved in space missions. And as you heard, I've been involved in north of 24 of them now on the science mission teams, and have led as the principal investigator 14 times now in that. I have to tell you, of all of those missions, and I've loved being a part of every one of them, space shuttle missions, suborbital sounding rocket missions, suborbital. It's not that hard to say, suborbital. This is Aggies. Thank you. But honestly, of all of those missions that I've been involved in, you know, it's like your children. You're not supposed to have a favorite, but I have to tell you, New Horizons is absolutely my favorite. There's really nothing else like it for my generation of planetary scientists. Back in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, in the Carl Sagan era, you know, all the first missions were taking place, the first missions to the moon, the first missions to Mars and Venus, the closer planets, and then eventually to Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus and Neptune. And the first missions were always the most prized. It's the ones that people wanted to be on the very most, because you're just opening presence. You're seeing something up close for the first time. And for my generation, by the time I was in graduate school in the late 80s, NASA had explored every planet in the solar system except Pluto, all the way out to Neptune. And for us, Pluto was the last train to Clarksville. It was the only chance in my generation to be a part of a first mission, of something like that. And as you know, it worked out pretty well. Pluto just turned out to be a scientific bonanza, and we were completely successful in a really complicated project that ultimately involved 2,500 men and women in this country to design and build that spacecraft, to test it, to design and build its rocket and its nuclear power supply, and to fly it all the way across our solar system. And every time I say that, it sounds like science fiction, but it's not. We actually launched the spacecraft and flew it to the very farthest frontier of our solar system and found the little planet with a heart on it. But I want to give you a little perspective, particularly those of you who aren't scientists or engineers. You know what this is? This is the best picture of Pluto ever made before New Horizons. And I heard, look, you're laughing. It's okay to laugh. I took this picture with a Hubble Space Telescope. That's not even the funny part. The funny part is we wrote a half a dozen scientific papers and gave press conferences over pictures like this. Right? This was the first picture to ever resolve Pluto as anything but a point of light. And it actually discovered Pluto's North Polar Cap, which you can see right there so clearly, right? So, you know, this is the reason we go to the planets, is because they're so far away that even with our best tools, this was made with the best telescope the world has ever seen, the Hubble Space Telescope. And still, because Pluto's only about the size of the continental United States, and you put it 3 billion miles away, you can't see anything. If you want to study the planets, you need imagery at least this good. This is a beautiful picture of the Earth taken by an Apollo mission. And from an image like this, you can very easily tell that the Earth is an ocean world, that it has an active, dynamic atmosphere, that it has continents that are made of rock. And you can learn many things. Look at the polar cap down at the South Pole. Very easy to tell. But if I take this image, which I've done, and pixelate it to the same scale as the Hubble image of Pluto, this is what you get. What could you learn about the Earth this way? Very, very little. You wouldn't even know that there were continents and oceans from this. So it's an object lesson that we have to go there because we don't have the technology to see these places up close, even with our best telescopes, from down here near the sun where the Earth orbits. Let me drive this point home. Any idea what we're looking at here? I heard Mars. It's an excellent guess and absolutely wrong. Okay, so I've made my point. We need to go there. And just at the time that the storied NASA Voyager mission was finishing its exploration of the giant planets of our solar system, flying by its last target, Neptune, in late 1989, a group of graduate students and young professors, who we dubbed ourselves the Pluto Underground, decided, wouldn't it be a nifty idea if we could talk NASA into doing what Voyager couldn't, and flying a mission to Pluto? And so we banded together, young men and young women, and decided that we would commit ourselves to seeing if we could figure out how to make this happen. How did we get to do this? Because you know how the story turned out. It turned out to take a long time, 26 years. And there was not a clear path, and none of us knew how to really pull it off. But because we were committed, every time we had a reversal, we picked ourselves back up off the floor and dusted ourselves off and started again and again. And every one of those cartoon views of different spacecraft with names beneath them down there failed to get off the drawing board until the last one, New Horizons. So we didn't just take one defeat and get up and have a success, or two defeats and get up and have a success. Throughout the late 80s and all of the 90s and into the early 2000s, time after time after time, we had to start over and reinvent it and figure out a better way until we finally found the key that would open the lock to the funding, almost $1 billion, a lot of money, to design the spacecraft and build it and buy the giant launch vehicle that goes with it to launch it and then ultimately fly it across the solar system. And it really took incredible commitment. I can't tell you how many times we thought we are doomed, we have run out of ideas, we are exhausted. I can tell you that I was told by people at NASA more than once, this is not good for your career. You should think about this. You could be writing more scientific papers. You're spending your time on this, and it's not going anywhere. But we as a group really were committed. We thought the science would be spectacular, and we thought the chance to be a part of a first mission was something like the stuff of dreams, something legendary like the first generation of planetary scientists got to do. And it turns out that during the same period in the 1990s, we were discovering what is called the Kuiper Belt, the third zone of our solar system, this disk of ancient building blocks of planets and small planets that litter the outer solar system. And we discovered Pluto's cohort. Pluto had been discovered back in 1930, more or less with an amateur telescope. But for decades, although people looked, they couldn't find anything else out there. And then a deluge of discoveries took place in the 90s. And one of the things that we discovered is that there are many small planets comparable in size to Pluto that are out there. In fact, these small planets, which we call dwarf planets, the same way that the Sun is called a dwarf star, these dwarf planets outnumber all the other planets of the solar system. Who's the misfit now, right? And in fact, the discovery of this third type of planet in our solar system was so powerful that when we went through this collaborative process in the early 2000s that the National Academy runs every 10 years, it's called the Decadal Survey, to figure out what should be the highest priorities for funding new missions to explore the solar system, the exploration of Pluto and the Kuiper Belt was ranked number one. Now, you've heard of that saying. Some people say sometimes, oh, it was like herding cats. Well, this is scientists. This is cats herding themselves. It is a lot more complicated. But it is a truly collaborative process in which every idea that anybody has can be brought forward, and the ideas are carefully considered and weighed with their benefits and their costs and their risks. And out of all that, out of literally sometimes hundreds of good ideas, comes a report that recommends two or three or four to actually get built. And because of the discovery of the Kuiper Belt and this plethora of tiny planets, which gave context to Pluto, the exploration mission that we ultimately named New Horizons was able to be funded. And then we competed. We formed a team when NASA called for proposals. NASA had five proposals turned in. And when I say a proposal, I mean something the thickness of an old New York City phone book with designs and cost and management plans and public outreach plans and very detailed schedules with thousands of schedule items on them. And a very, very intensive process. And our team was kind of the underdogs. And yet we knew that if we collaborated deeply enough and wrote a spotless proposal that we could compete in the big leagues. And in fact, this is the cover of our proposal from back in 2001, and our proposal was judged the best. And so the mission to Pluto and the Kuiper Belt became New Horizons, the name of our proposal, because that's where we were going, after all, to New Horizons. But then I don't think any of us really realized the commitment that it took over the next few years to get this designed and built. Let me put it in perspective. This menage, this group of photos summarizes for me the blur of the years 2002 to 2005. We had to launch this spacecraft in January of 2006 because that was the last opportunity in the entire decade and all the way out into the middle of the next decade, around 2015, to get a Jupiter gravity assist to fly fast across the solar system. And so we only had 4 years to do what Voyager and previous missions had had 7, 8, 9 years to design and build and test the spacecraft. And so it was a complete blur. I remember when we were getting ready to launch New Horizons, asking my assistant how many trips I'd taken on that project in 4 years. And she said, Alan, 232. I live in Denver, that's United Airlines. If you've ever had a single meal on United Airlines, you can imagine what a service to your country 232 flights on United are. And I was no different from anybody else. We were working nights and weekends, 52 weeks a year, on this breakneck schedule. And we didn't have the money to build two of these. we only had enough funding to build one. So it had to work. It's not just that we had to get to the launch pad. It had to then work for more than a decade in space to get to Pluto. That only happens through collaborations. This is a picture taken of our team back in 2004. Actually, as I said, 2,500 people worked on this. This is the leadership team. And the picture is taken at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab where we built the spacecraft. And it was, you know, spaceflight is a team sport. A lot of things are. But, you know, spaceflight projects are so complex. There's never, ever been a spaceflight conducted by a single individual. In fact, it takes so many different specialties, people that know about propulsion and software and guidance and communications and reliability engineering and public outreach and schedules and management and the science and the scientific instruments. And we could go on and on and on. And so you really have to collaborate in spaceflight to make it work. And you have to trust the people who have all the expertise in these different areas in order to make it work. And I think that, for me, has been a life lesson on all these spaceflight projects that I've been involved in, how if you put the right team together and you break down the barriers and you come to trust one another, how collaboration really lets people in teams achieve things that are larger than life, that you could never hope to achieve without that collaborative process. Now, we also had to make some intelligent compromises along the way. This is a cartoon drawing of our spacecraft. And for scale, that dish antenna is about 7 feet across. So the spacecraft is much smaller than the stage, only weighs about 1,000 pounds. I told you that we only had half the time that the Voyager team had to build our spacecraft. We also had a limit on our budget that was only one-fifth what the Voyager team had to build their mission and fly it. And so we had to invent new ways to do this. One thing we did was we decided we would only fly one spacecraft so that we could save money on that, but we knew that that was taking some real risks, so we compensated with more of this reliability engineering that I talked about and heavier testing of the spacecraft we built so that we could weed out parts for infant mortality and things like that. But also, we made a very conscious decision to have very, very slow data transmission rates back to Earth. It would take us more than a year to get all the data back from Pluto because by choosing lower power transmitters, we could get away with only one nuclear power generator on the spacecraft, and those babies cost about $100 million apiece. So by accepting lower data rates, that in the end, through the chain of engineering, saved over $100 million. We also invented software packages that allowed the spacecraft to take care of itself most of the journey to Pluto. So our flight control team wasn't the 450 people of Voyager. It's 50 people, 50 belly buttons. That's the flight controllers, the engineers, the scientists, the project management, everybody. 2,500 people to build it. And right after we launched, there's just 50 of us, just like that one little group of chairs right here. And we looked around at each other early in 2006 and said, it's just us. We have to fly the ship across the solar system for 10 years, and we better not make a mistake. Here's the spacecraft that we built. You can see it with people. This is in a clean room down in Florida, just before we put it up on the rocket, the launch vehicle. And, you know, so I like this picture because it really shows you the substructure of the spacecraft. There are people there for scale. But we had a lot of problems, and every one of them had to be solved. There was no, I can't face this. So we encourage people to bring us problems as often as they could, not to make problems, but to expose problems early so we could solve them when they were small, before they grew and metastasized into something. And we ran out of schedule and cost flexibility to solve those problems. And we rewarded people for bringing problems forward so that we could solve them. And I think on any big project, and certainly in my other spaceflight projects, this has been a very important principle that's been a big part of making things successful. So anyway, so we got the spacecraft built. We put it in the nose cone of the rocket. The launch vehicle is enormous. I'll show it to you in a minute. Here's the spacecraft in the nose cone on the day that we fueled the nuclear reactor. And because it was radioactively hot, they wanted to close that radiation barrier door. But they let us have a few of us take our picture, and I asked to go last as the mission principal investigator. And it wasn't, I wish I could say it was out of being polite to everybody else. You know, you go ahead. Really, I just knew at that moment that if I go last, that's the last picture anyone ever took of New Horizons. They closed the door and no one's ever seen it since. We launched it less than a week later. So I'm very proud of that picture. And it really, and by the way, for any of you who are superstitious, that was Friday the 13th. Never worried me a bit. So here's our launch vehicle. It's called an Atlas V. It is, at that time, it was the biggest launch vehicle in the industry and the most powerful. It consists of a liquid propulsion first stage with two engines on it and five solid rocket motor strap-ons that were built here in Utah, and then a second stage and then a third stage up in that nose cone. It's about 220 feet tall. It weighs about 2 million pounds. It's the size of a downtown building. And I'll show you the launch in a minute. And unlike any downtown building, and even unlike the F-18s that are Mach 2 fighter attack aircraft that I used to fly missions on, this thing can take off vertically, a downtown building. And as you will see in this video of the launch, it went supersonic in half a minute, actually 28 seconds. It is one amazing thing to see one of these launches. And I, you know, I was a little kid building model rockets and really interested in all this stuff. And I have to tell you, to be able to order this rocket, completely tricked out for performance in every way, was like the most amazing experience after having been Estes model rockets, you know, mowing lawns to earn money for that. But anyway, we did launch. We launched on the 19th of January, 2006. And here's a video of the launch.
Status check.
I'll let you listen. Atlas.
This is Atlas Launch Control at T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition and liftoff of NASA's New Horizons spacecraft on a decade-long voyage to visit the planet Pluto and then beyond. That's 15 seconds.
15 seconds and it's already bursting through clouds 2 miles high.
Away from Florida's East Coast. Five solid rocket strap-on boosters are burning just fine, sending the New Horizons spacecraft on its way to the very edge of our solar system.
So the next thing is staging, where those solid rocket motors run out of propellant and we ditch them, we detach them so that we can accelerate without their dead weight. Now you'll see the nose cone come off because we're high enough that there's no air resistance anymore and we're already in space. There it goes. And that's it. 8 minutes. Thank you. Eight minutes after it left that launch pad, it was in orbit going 18,000 miles an hour. We flew halfway around the Earth and over the Middle East, reignited the second stage to take us out of Earth orbit. And then the third stage accelerated the spacecraft at 14 Gs. Really, no human could survive that. And by the time the third stage burned out, the spacecraft was traveling so fast, as you heard earlier, it became the fastest spacecraft ever launched. We travel almost 1 million miles every day, 7 days a week and 52 weeks a year. For comparison, when Apollo missions launched to the moon, at 25,000 miles an hour, it took those astronauts 3 days to reach the moon. New Horizons crossed the orbit of the moon 9 hours after launch. Really unbelievable. This looks so easy. It's just a little cartoon. Oh, we just crossed the solar system. It's 3 billion miles, took 9.5 years, and don't screw it up. But I want to break that down a little bit. When we first launched from the Earth, we flew to that Jupiter gravity assist flyby. It took us 13 months to get to Jupiter. The mission before us had taken 4.5 years to get to Jupiter. The one before that took 6 years to get to Jupiter. So we were really going lickety-split. And Jupiter was not just our gravity flyby to add almost 5,000 miles per hour to our speed, but it was the only thing we passed along the way. And so it was our flight test. It was our opportunity to make sure that if there were going to be any bugs in any of the software or the operation of the systems or the instruments, that we could work it out at Jupiter so that it would work flawlessly at Pluto 8 years later. And all of that did work. Completely flawless flyby. We proved all of our systems and all of our software conducted over 700 scientific observations of Jupiter and its satellites. This is a picture made in color by New Horizons of Jupiter and its volcanic moon Io. And you can see we made the cover of the Rolling Stone for Geeks Science magazine. And then after we left Jupiter, we flew on across all the giant planets of our solar system over 8 years. Basically, the entire two-term Obama administration, we were out crossing the solar system on our way to Pluto. This is a very nice little graphic that makes it look like we missed. I promise you, we did not miss. And during those 8 years, people would ask all the time. I would see friends, and they'd say, "Are you working on New Horizons? What are you doing? Like, that spacecraft's hibernating." You know, and the 50 of us were working like crazy. The Voyager flight team, it had almost 500 people on it. So we were 10 times smaller, and yet we had to do all the same things. Navigate the spacecraft, take care of all of its systems, have the instruments calibrated, do crew science, and plan this flawless flyby of Pluto that we only had one shot at. And if it hadn't worked, I would not be standing here speaking to you today. I would be in some desert island hiding out. And actually, we had to plan four different flybys of Pluto and test every one of them because we didn't know which one we were going to pull out of the drawer until we got our early observations. So we were really busy. But as 2015 dawned, we took the spacecraft out of hibernation for the last time. We were on approach. This is Glenn Fountain in the lower left, our long-term project manager at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, and Becca Sipan, one of our flight controllers in our mission control in Maryland. And I just want to talk a minute for the nerds in the audience, the engineering and science majors. In order for the science to work out, we had to carefully target our flyby. So we had to arrive at a very specific point in space to within just a few tens of miles after a journey of 3 billion miles. Really, really astounding. And somebody did the arithmetic, and I checked it, and it's right. It's the equivalent of hitting a golf ball in L.A. and sinking a hole-in-one in New York City. In terms of targeting. And in addition, because the spacecraft was counting in its computer on knowing where Pluto and all of its satellites were in space as it passed by, we also had to arrive in a very narrow timing window of plus or minus 450 seconds, which is 9 minutes, plus or minus 9 minutes after 9.5 years. I will tell you that I flew from Denver to Salt Lake yesterday, and the airline I flew on could not meet that criteria. But we arrived at Pluto 86 seconds off target after 9.5 years, and I'm proud to say we were early. Thank you. Okay, so then we arrived in the Pluto system. Here's kind of a family portrait, Pluto in the lower right. In the distance, this picture is actually taken from millions of miles away. And remember, Pluto's about the width of the continental United States. Behind it is, or to the upper left, is its biggest satellite, whose name is Charon, about the size of the state of Texas. And then two of its four tiny satellites are also seen there. This is Pluto and its big moon. In false color, where we've exaggerated the colors in the computer just so you can see more clearly what's redder and what's other colors, and you can see the difference between these two worlds, Pluto and Charon. And right away, as soon as we started getting pictures like this back, we were able to tell we were really on to something special, that this place, despite being a small planet, was very vibrant and very active, and it was going to have a lot to teach us about the origin of the solar system and about how all these small planets work out in the distant outer solar system. And I'm just give you a very quick tour of a little bit of data. Here's Pluto, where we took images from New Horizons and wrapped them on a sphere in the computer as if you were an astronaut flying over the surface, what you would see. The biggest thing that you see there is that big white oval. That is the western side of the heart of Pluto. It is a nitrogen glacier the size of Texas and Oklahoma combined, about 1 million square kilometers. And it is ringed by mountain ranges that are much taller than the mountains to the east of Provo. Some of them are 15 and 20,000 feet high. And those mountains were almost certainly created by an impact of an asteroid onto Pluto that carved out the basin that that nitrogen glacier is in. And by the way, speaking of glaciers, no one expected to find glaciers, which are common on the Earth and Mars. We hadn't seen them anywhere else in the solar system, and then we found them at the end of the line at Pluto. I didn't have a single glaciologist on my geology team. And then I found myself in the summer of 2015, like, who do we know that's a glaciologist? But the place is just simply amazing. This is a difficult to see, but it's better up here on the Jumbotron. This is one of the most memorable pictures to me. It's a picture of a set of mountain ranges on Pluto, a planet in the Kuiper Belt, 3 billion miles from home, with snow caps, just like you have outside today. Except those bright snow caps are not made of water ice, and we chemically fingerprinted them with New Horizons. They're made of methane, natural gas. Do not light a match on Pluto. But just the thought of mountains and snow caps in the Kuiper Belt is just magical to me. Here's a picture of some very old terrain on Pluto. We know it's old because it's covered in craters. And just like if it's raining outside and you run outside with a piece of paper, the longer you leave the paper out in the rain, the more dots you'll see. The more impacts, the older the surface. But right next to this place, which we've age dated in the computer as 4.5 billion years old, is this place on the glacier. And that entire glacier the size of Texas and Oklahoma has no great craters. And so it must be very young. In fact, it must only be at the most millions of years old, which means that Pluto is somehow 4.5 billion years after being born, still geologically active and creating terrains of the scale of Texas all the time. And no one knows how it does that. And no one expected this. It is a complete rethink of the way planetary geophysics works on these small worlds. And we found avalanches out of those mountain ranges that pour out into the glacier and recharge it. We found ice volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa in Hawaii. We even found what we think is a frozen lake that indicates that Pluto used to have a much thicker nitrogen atmosphere than it has now. That lake has a shoreline. It sits in a hanging valley in the mountains, just like lakes you would visit here in the mountains of Utah. And we know it's in a hanging valley because we have stereo images and we have the topography. This is a set of images made as if you were flying over Pluto. These are made in black and white from a high-resolution camera, starting at the North Pole and drifting down onto the glacier. So come with me and fly over the surface of Pluto with New Horizons images and look into the interior. Use the craters as your windows into the interior. Watch for what we believe are dust devil tracks across the surface where something like tornadoes operated on the surface of Pluto, and then onto badlands and eventually big mountain blocks. But these mountains are not made of rock. They're made of water ice, and then they're crusted in nitrogen and methane. And off onto the glacier, and look at those dune fields on the surface. And by the way, Professor Jani Radabaugh here at BYU is one of the principal authors of the Nature paper that discovered those dune fields on Pluto. How about a hand for her and her work? So as you can imagine, this was a lot of work. It took 26 years to pull this off. There was the fundraising and political stage. There was the competition stage. There was building it, breakneck schedule, and then a flight across the solar system for 10 years. This is a candid picture taken by a New York City photographer named Michael Soluri, who was embedded in our team, on the morning of the flyby. These are science team members at the moment that the very first high-resolution image appeared on the big screen at our mission control. And you can just feel the emotion in that room. For people who worked on this for 15 years to make it happen, who had to trust one another in this very complicated collaboration, who had to be committed across a decade and a half to make this happen, and who only had one shot at making it work with one spacecraft that could not make a U-turn and come back if we blew it. It was just an amazing experience. And for all the science that we've done ever since, seeing my team achieve that and the emotion that they felt, I can't tell you how many times people have told me on the team, I've never worked on a mission there was anything like this that I ever had that kind of emotional attachment to. Because everyone was doing something larger than life. That's what I think. And I'm just going to close two things. First, an unabashed advertisement. If you want to know more about New Horizons, this is the book that took 2 years. I call it my 100 Lost Weekends that David Grinspoon and I wrote back in 2017 and 18, and it was published in 2018. And you can find it on Amazon. It's out in paperback now. And it really tells a lot more stories than I could tell in the last half hour. And I'll just close with this slide. It's my favorite picture of the entire flyby, not as a scientist, but as a human being. What you're looking at is a picture of Pluto backlit by the sun, taken in true color. This is Pluto's beautiful blue atmosphere, just like the Earth's atmosphere, also made of nitrogen, the same stuff that you're breathing. And the reason I like this picture so much is there's only one way to get this picture. In order to get a picture of Pluto backlit by the sun, your spacecraft has to be on the far side of Pluto. You have to have accomplished the project. And after 26 years and 2,500 colleagues and many reversals and many successes, this is the picture that says it all for me, because that team of people did it, and they did it spectacularly. Thank you very much.